February 4th. Agenda, call to order.
Say the time for me.
Oh, the time.
It's still me.
6:05.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take roll. All right. So Chair Strauss is absent. Vice Chair, it's going to be Vice Chair Hill, is also absent right now. Member Drummond?
Here.
Member Johnson?
Here.
Member Jessup?
Here.
Member Medeiros?
Here.
And Member Oakley is also going to be absent today.
But we do have a quorum. Public comment?
We do not have any public comments today.
So 3-1 says submit a written comment card at www.henryville.org/advisorybodies.
Yes, and no, nobody has submitted any advisory, any comment cards. They have not come to be from the clerk's office.
Okay. So our approval for our regular meeting minutes for January is 7. Approve those.
Motion to approve.
Motion to approve.
What's that?
Do
you need to take a second?
I have a second.
Meeting
minutes have been.
Oh, let me say that. Let me take the rolls. Dolores was filling in for you.
Thank you. My meeting was late.
Apologies.
Go ahead.
All right. So we were approving the minutes, and we did get a first from Brooks and a second from Drummond. So I will take the vote. So we have. Vice Chair Hill for the minutes.
Aye.
And Member Johnson.
Aye.
Member Drummond.
Aye. Yes.
Member Jessup.
Aye.
And Member Medeiros. Great. Minutes pass.
No. Okay. Moving on to 5 action items. 5.1, appointments to the Visual Arts and Community Promotions Grant Subcommittee.
Yes. Okay. So every year the city does a round of grant applications, one for the Community Promotions Grant, and then every other year we do our Visual Art Grant grant committee opportunities. Council has determined that there are 5 different positions that sit on these subcommittees. Parks and Recs automatically gets a position, Public Art, Commission on Aging, and Economic Development. The 5th seat is open to somebody who sits on any of the other committees that's interested in participating. And so that would be Housing Advisory Committee, the Budget Advisory Committee, and the Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee. So what we're asking for is if anybody is interested in serving on the Visual Arts Grant Committee or the Community Promotions Grant Subcommittee, that you guys submit those nominations. We can have one person do both, or we can have one person for one committee and another person be recommended for the second committee. That person does need to be able to attend, to review the applications and then attend approximately 2 meetings in March.
Can I put a little bit of context on it as well? Because I am probably partially responsible that we're looking at this year because...
Every year. Yeah, we did it last year. And in fact, Sarah was recommended from the committee
did it
last year.
Because after our committee meeting last time, I did attend the Public Art Advisory Committee meeting and tried to sort of make a case because I think it's... because our public art and housing are so closely connected, I think... particularly for, you know, making the city more livable, basically, mm-hmm. for residents over time. I think from like a macro perspective, public art has been like a key part of the transition to make Emeryville into like a more welcoming, you know, fun place to live, more enjoyable place to live as residents. And then on like a micro level as well, the connection between the visual arts grants in particular and housing is really close. So for example, where I live outside at the Emory, like right outside my door is one of the big public murals. Like I see it every time I go in and out of my apartment, and mm-hmm. It's the treasure map, which is like a famous piece of public art in the city. And like, I love it. Like it is, amazing. And I, it uplifts me, like every time that I notice it or I see people like admiring and I feel super proud about it. But it could go the other way too, right? If you, you know, live somewhere and a large piece of public art that sort of dominates the area outside where you live goes up, it isn't something that like you enjoy and makes, you know, your life better, but it goes the other direction, can also affect you as well. And so this visual arts grant, part of the requirement is actually that when you do an application, you have to go to all of the people who live nearby and ask for their permission because it affects their housing, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so there's this really close connection between this public art grant and housing in particular. And yet I thought it was unfortunate that like no one from housing is in one of those key spots. Right. And so I tried to make a case to the public art community that you should have a housing perspective on these on the committee that reviews these applications and make sure that there's a housing perspective represented there. And they did agree in that meeting to make a recommendation from public art to council that the fifth member should be someone from housing, that it could be anyone, but they said they were going to make a recommendation that it should be someone from housing. Mm-hmm.
From your perspective, is there a pro to having the same person on the visual arts? Like, is there some relation?
There's not.
Yeah.
Okay. Two separate application periods. I think what they've done in the past is they combine them together.
Got it.
And they realized that was too much.
Okay.
So it is two separate applications. And so people had to apply to one or the other.
Got it.
Instead of what they did in the past was just had one application and it was just way too much. So they've separated it.
Okay.
So it could be about a matter of time,
okay,
whether or not somebody has the time to really review all those applications that come in.
Got it.
Related to those.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And everything that I just said is more applicable to the visual arts grant. I know a lot less about the community promotions grant, but my understanding is that it could be like special events,
mm-hmm,
and all sorts of things like that. So
mm-hmm,
beyond just an art installation.
Yeah, is there any more context to the community promotion grant?
So the community, they are usually events. I personally am familiar with two. So we had the Color Connections, which did a series of art courses over at the Senior Center for people to come out and practice mindfulness and learn about art and things like that. So that was funded through the Community Promotions Grant. I think there's been small events that people have had. Community Services really runs the Community Promotions Grants, and a lot of it is activities that then would service the community in some form or fashion. The other program I think that was recommended in the past that I funded through my CDBG funds because I had extra money was a program at the after-school program. It was art and astronomy for the kids. So it was an after-school program for the kids at Emory Unified School to learn more about astronomy, and it had an art component to it as well.
And then how many events do they usually have in a year?
Oh, I don't know.
Is it like,
I think they're
200 or like 12?
I was saying like they usually get around 25 applicants for the community grants, and then they move half of them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Something like that.
What people are asking for. Yeah.
Thinking about workload. Yeah. Like reading all of them.
How many do the grants range from?
How
much do the grants range from? 1,000 to 5,000?
Guys are asking me questions.
Visual arts, I think, go up to 17, like up to about 17,500. You don't have to apply for all of it.
Community
is like 10, right?
Yeah. You guys are knowing more than me because I don't know.
That's good.
Someone
that gave me an idea.
What are the qualifications to apply for the events?
Apply to be on the subcommittee or
to run an event. So you already said that it's like education, right?
Oh, so we're looking for somebody to be on the like approving end of the application.
Correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, I had another question that kind of removed. But I think in terms of they have a whole outline of the application process for grants. Anybody can apply.
So this is the visual art grant here.
It's a little bit different because for visual arts grants, you don't have to be a resident of Emeryville, which actually was something I asked about in the visual arts grants workshop, because I do think that this should prioritize the support of Emeryville-based artists. But that's not technically a requirement. I think for the community promotion grants, it is a requirement that you are. It's not?
Okay. You just have to service the Emeryville community.
Yeah. Okay. It's about serving the community versus where somebody's coming from. Okay. So, you could potentially get, a nonprofit who wants to do something. Emeryville doesn't have a lot of nonprofits, so but it's about serving the community, not necessarily about it being coming from the residents.
That makes sense for the community. Yeah. Motion grants.
I am fine.
For a community promotion grant? Okay, so you know all the requirements here now.
And so you do need support. So if you're working with partners in the community, you need to get letters of support from them showing that you're done. And so it is really community oriented. Yeah, so it's nice. And every person, say if you're partnering with someone that is a provider outside of Emeryville, the projects or event still needs to take place in Emeryville.
I see.
So that it's either using the facilities or, working, giving back to the community.
Yeah, so the organization or the individual or the activity must benefit or must occur in Emeryville. So that's why you could have somebody who doesn't reside in Emeryville participate in it. You're not required to be a nonprofit or sponsored by a non-fiscal agent. There are insurance requirements. Let's see what else do we have on here.
Can you be a marketing person, take the marketing role, and be an applicant?
You mean by the marketing role?
On the subcommittee.
Yeah.
I believe it would be a conflict. Okay. So I think if you're looking to apply for one of the subcommittees, then you could not be in the review.
Yeah. Okay. Because I was I would do the art one, maybe. The art committee sounds fun, but I just have a very strong commitment in March, and without having those dates available, it makes it hard.
Mm-hmm.
My kids have a date.
You should do the community promotion.
But I would love to do the arts one. But I just wonder how that would work, if we had conflict with that date in March. How hard is that?
Yeah.
State?
And then you have to review the applications too, right? So there's two prongs, is to review the applications
my own time frame, it's
fine. Yeah.
But the hard date.
The hard date, understood.
What that is.
I'd also be super interested in the arts grant as well. I've been trying to learn as much as I can about that particular program.
So we can also do an alternate. So we can submit a recommendation and an alternate. Because I think what I'm hearing is Brooks and Julia both have the interest in the art.
Right.
If you guys wanted to make one of you guys the alternate and the other one the...
I can be backup. Okay. Yeah. Brooks. Yeah. I feel that's appropriate for you to be on that.
That's what I hear.
Okay. So that's the visual art. So we can do it all together for the community promotions. Mm-hmm. Is there anybody interested in doing
interested in the community promotions grant specifically? Then we should talk about that. But if not, I'm happy to serve across both. But if someone else would like to serve, is interested in volunteering.
I don't know what dates. If I knew the dates in March, because go out of town next month.
I don't think they have the dates in here.
They have a review.
Yeah, just this March. They don't have the specific dates identified.
Is anyone else interested in community promotions grant?
And you don't have to nominate anybody. It's the fifth space will be filled by somebody from one of three committees.
Got it. Okay.
So there's no guarantee, even if you are interested, you will get the spot.
Okay.
And if we don't have anybody who's interested, then we don't submit a recommendation from the committee. It will be filled by somebody from another committee.
Okay.
The other thing that they'll also do is that for whatever reason, housing budget and bicycle ped
don't have somebody who's interested, mm-hmm. then they will take additional people from one of those original four groups that are also interested in serving. So it is okay if there is nobody who wants to do it. You're not obligated.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have a motion.
All right, should I put my head for vote? It seems it could be a lot. Maybe I will limit myself to the visual arts grant just because that could be a lot of applications to review at 1 month. If I was to do both.
That's okay. So Brooke and then Julia as the backup for the visual art committee. Is that the motion?
Yes.
Okay. And then so do we have a first and a second?
I can make the motion for Brooks for visual arts and Julie as an alternate.
Yeah.
Okay. And then do we have a second?
A second.
All right. I'll take the roll. Vice Chair Tyler?
Aye.
Member Drummond?
Aye.
Member Johnson?
Aye.
Member Jessup?
Aye.
Member Madeira? All right. That passes. Thanks, John. And no recommendation for the grant subcommittee. Right. Not the community grant. Okay.
I could.
And I will let them know that it would be helpful if they had those specific days for next year.
Yeah.
When they're asking people to donate their time so that they can make sure it aligns. I will give that recommendation to the staff. Okay. So are we ready for item 5?
5.2, the Housing Element Annual Progress Report?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so the Housing Element Annual Progress Report. So just a little background. Since 1969, California has had the requirement that all cities and counties are required to adequately plan to meet the housing needs of everybody in their community. The Regional Housing Needs Assessment, or RHNA, as most people call it, is California's required process for determining that and ensuring every city and county plans for enough housing to accommodate all the economic segments of the community. So that's people of all different income levels. Everybody's required to plan for it. Each city and county must adopt a housing element to demonstrate how they will accommodate its assigned RHNA allocation through zoning or potential rezoning opportunities. The housing element also describes all of the housing needs and conditions of that jurisdiction. It'll establish housing goals, policies, programs, and implementation actions to help further housing opportunities. Every April 1st, every jurisdiction must submit their housing element annual report. Our 2023 to 2031 housing element was certified by the state on February 3rd, 2023. And so this is our third annual progress report related to the current housing element. So just a summary, because it is, I sent you guys the summary report, but I also sent you the entire draft report, which is super, super long. It doesn't appear long. What's long is table D. And we'll talk a little bit about table D. But so every part of the housing element, there is a different table that has to be completed and we have to answer questions. So table A talks about our housing development applications that were submitted in 2025. So for the year, we had a total of 4 applications that were submitted proposing 9 different units. You'll see on the table, 2 of them were single family detached and 9 of them were... Is that right? Yeah. And then 9 of them were accessory dwelling units. We have 8 units that have been approved, which are all of the accessory dwelling units. And then we have 1 application that is still pending. So it was not approved yet. None of those units utilized any streamlining provisions because they were all ADUs and there isn't one for that. None of them are located in historic designations. None of them have a deed restriction. They were all ministerial approvals that were done at the staff level. And so there was no discretionary project that was required to go before the Planning Commission. And then our affordability source, we're required to document how we're determining what income level is related to the units. and ABAG, which is the regional organization for the Greater Bay Area, has produced an ADU affordability report that has been approved by the state for us in this region to utilize. Where basically we can allocate our ADUs to 30, 30, 30, and 10. So 30% of the units can be documented as very low, 30% as low income, 30% as moderate, and 10% as above moderate. And so that's what we're allowed to use in trying to determine. So this is what's happened. These are the applications, again, that came in 2025, and that's Table A. We go to Table A2, and A2 is extremely long. It's broken up into three different segments, so I'll talk about each segment. A2 is what applications for entitlement were actually approved. And the reason that they document this differently than Table A is because there could have been an application that was submitted in the past but didn't get approved, but actually was approved this year. Mm-hmm. So that's why they separate them. The first one is just about who applied. The second one is about what actually got approved. Sometimes there's overlap, and we have overlap this year. So this year we had five applications for a total of 375 units. One of those was a large multifamily project. That was our Christie sites that's proposing 362 units. The other four applications were related to accessory dwelling units, which was going to produce 13 units. None of these sites are located in a historic designation. The one large multifamily project did use our streamlining provision, which is now called SMAP. It basically means that you can go through a ministerial approval process at the staff level without having to go to the full council or to the planning commission for approval if it's 100% affordable housing.
What is the ministerial? That just means that
That is done at the staff level.
Out here.
Yeah, the staff does the review and approval. The planning commission does discretionary approvals. So that's where there's discretion that can be made about what can be done. Only certain projects now are required to be discretionary and go before the city planning commission. When it's not going before them, then it's done ministerial by the staff.
Okay.
Yeah.
And accessory dwelling
units.
Technically different from what's technically different about them?
So accessory dwelling units are like granny flats. It's an ADU. So it's a unit that's usually built in the back of the house or could be adjacent, like somebody can turn their basement into an ADU. Yeah. Okay. There's a lot of different ways. It also includes what's called a junior ADU, which has certain regulatory requirements, but they're captured in the report altogether.
Okay.
So that one large multifamily, which is the Christie site, it did use the streamlining provision. It also is a deed restricted property because it has a density bonus that it received. It'll be affordable for 99 years once built. Because of the streamlining provisions, they were eligible for concessions and waivers. They received four concessions and waivers related to development standards of the project. For all the units that were entitled in 2025, none of them are related to projects that required the demolition or destruction of any units. And then again, for the affordability of our ADUs, we were able to use the ABAC ADU affordability.
And what does it mean by when it says they have waivers for development standards? What is that?
So a couple of years ago, we adopted what's called objective design standards. So there are standards that the city has that a developer has to meet and when they're building in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be something in regards to the size of a certain room or like where a window needs to be placed. It could be related to a material or the fact that you have to have outdoor space, parking.
Mm-hmm.
So when they get concessions and waivers, it means that they're allowed to bypass whatever the rule is in order to build the project. So they wouldn't have had to meet the parking requirement potentially or the outdoor requirement. Maybe they got a waiver on our family-friendly guidelines, so they didn't have to have rooms be of a certain size.
Mm-hmm.
There's tons of things that it could relate to. It could be any of those.
Where do we see that?
Yeah.
Like, how do we, because like, that's what I want to know. What
it's
already done.
It's already been done.
Mm-hmm. So
The way the state law is written is that when you are submitting 100% affordable housing project, there's a state law that says you get unlimited waivers and concessions.
Oh, okay.
So we don't have the authority to tell them no. They can ask for whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Does it disclose to the public what waivers were provided?
When it goes to, yeah, the Planning Commission would get that information.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it's public record.
Okay.
Well,
I think if you wanted to go look it up.
You would have to, the place to look it up would be going back to when they last presented to the Planning Commission and looking at the staff report.
But I'm curious, like, just with my understanding of certain things that happen and how this plays into, like, budgeting for when maybe in 10 years from now, this same building is asking for, like, the grants that were, or the loans that were just given out.
It wouldn't be those type of things.
Like, windows weren't placed where they were supposed to be placed, and then it impacted ventilation, and then it impacted...
No.
Like, concentration, or...
And I probably shouldn't have said windows, because windows is not a good one.
Okay.
It's more, like, architectural type of things that could happen. Okay. So, like, there's a certain height requirement, maybe. And so, in order to build what they want, maybe they didn't have 12-foot ceilings and only had 10, and we were able to do it. Or you'll notice on a lot of our 100% affordable housing projects, they don't have balconies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's because there was a concession or a waiver of the outdoor space requirement.
Mm-hmm.
But you see it on mixed-income projects because... they can't get that same kind of waiver. It could be a waiver in regards to the number of parking spaces that you're required to have, or it could be a waiver, I'm trying to think, they've done one on density,
mm-hmm.
like the number of units or like how big certain things are.
So interesting. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. But the state law says unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And the density bonus program has a certain allocations for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So let me move on to the next page. Okay. So the next part of table A2 is buildings permitted in 2025. It goes on the exact same table as the last entitlement section. So we actually had 3 applications that were issued building permits in 2025 that will produce 6 units. You can see the income breakdown as to where those are on the screen. Again, none of them were in historic designations. There was no streamlining provisions. There's no deed restrictions. None of those units are replacing something that was demolished or destroyed. And again, we use the ADU affordability source report. One thing I didn't mention before that's brand new is the state implemented a law that now requires everybody in their housing element to track units for acutely low income. Acutely low income. We've never done that before. And so let me just tell you guys how the categories work. So moderate income is typically people between 81 and 120% of the area median income. Low income are people between 51 and 80%. Very low income, people between 31 and 50. Extremely low, used to be everybody below 30. But now, because they have acutely low is people 15% and below. So extremely low is people whose income is between 16 and 30%
AMI. What is the median income right now? Do you know, Ronnie?
I'll look it up. I'll look it up. Yeah, I'll open it. Let me.
It could be
possible.
It could be
maybe now, though, I think. Like 121?
In my student days, I might have qualified to be low.
Let's see here what it says.
We're going off of city, right?
No. Hold on, let me stop sharing so you guys can see the new screen. Stop sharing. And what?
A census tract?
No. It's for the statistical, the metropolitan statistical area.
Okay.
So, yeah, let me see if I can use
130. Oh, it's good to have that breakdown.
So this would be for what's called the Oakland-Fremont PMSA. So what's not included in this was San Francisco. It does include everything in Alameda County and Contra Costa County.
Oh.
We're all the same part of, we're all a part of the same metropolitan statistical area. So this is, and you see, I don't have on here acutely low. I will have to add that next year. But yeah, this is how it's determined. It comes from information from HUD. It actually will, when we get the new income chart, that'll come back to you guys. Usually it comes to you guys at the in June. But we just got a notice saying that HUD is supposed to release it usually in April, so they're not going to release it until May. Once HUD releases it, then the state has to do their stuff, and then the state releases it. So I have a feeling it's going to be late. We may not get it until July or August. But yeah, that's how it is. So for a household of one, the median income would be the 111, and then for a household of four, it'd be 159.
Do you guys have city data of like what the makeup is of these for our current residents and tenants?
No. I mean, we could look at census data a little bit. The problem is census data isn't going to equate it completely this way. It'll tell us about household income. I don't know that it's going to break it down by household size. Okay, so we go back. Presentation.
I just turned on my phone to take a picture. Did it do it again? Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. So permits filed. So the third part of the report is where did we get a permit that was filed, which means that the project construction is complete and it's ready for someone to move into the unit. So here we had 7 applications where the permits were filed that would produce 99 units. One of the large projects that says 92 units is actually 90 units that's coming from Nellian and Gateway, that it received its final permit, and it actually also received its certificate of occupancy in 2025. So none of these units are in a historic designation. We had one that went through the SMAP process, which is that Nellian and Gateway project. That project will be affordable for 75 years. That project received 6 waivers or concessions of their development standards. We did have one of these projects, which was a part of a project where there had previously been 2 units that were demolished, and then we had 2 units built. And again, all the ADU information is based on the ABAG ADU affordability report. And I believe the 2 units that were demolished were a part of the new 2-unit detached units.
Mm-hmm.
That's where those are coming from. So all of that data then feeds into Table B. So Table B is a summary of all the permitting activity for the current year and previous years.
Mm-hmm.
So when the state looks at whether or not a city or a county is meeting their RENA, they are only calculating based off of the permits issued. So they're not looking at entitlements, they're not looking at the final permits, but when a permit is issued, that's when they actually count it towards the number. So you'll see that our RENA allocation for Emeryville is 1,815. And as of the end of 2025, we have produced, that is not right. Does that say 1,415? That number is not right.
Is it 145?
I think it's supposed to be 145. So I need to fix that. If you can remind me of that. Yeah, we need to fix that.
That's why we're going through the draft.
Yeah. Well, and I manually put this in there, so the actual report auto tabulates everything.
Oh, okay.
So I must have typed something wrong here.
So is it misleading then? Because if you just look at this, it looks like the housing pipeline has slowed down significantly since 2023. We were like flying, and then 24 and 25 looks like it's slowed down.
Oh, no, that's absolutely correct.
It is correct.
Oh, that's okay. Completely correct.
Okay.
It has been a slow trickle. If it wasn't for ADUs, we probably wouldn't have much of anything going on.
Okay, so...
Which is a market
issue. It's a big picture question, and I guess that's what the annual report is about, but like... What is behind this slowdown, and are we in danger of... We were doing so well in 2023. We like won awards for it and everything. So like, what is happening? And like, are we in danger of like not making it to meet the goals?
No, that's a great question. So it is a market issue. It's not just us. It's just slowed down across the board, especially here in our region. The numbers are just kind of dribbling in for whatever reason. Some cities are having better luck and their things are moving a little bit faster, but overall I'd say residential development is slow. There's financial reasons for that. I think there's economic reasons of what's just going on in the industry, interest rates. So there's a lot of different outside sources that are impacting why we're not seeing more development activity here.
But it's not internal policy change.
It's not an internal policy change, which is why the requirement for RENA is that a city must have planned for development.
Oh.
Because at the end of the day, I can't force anybody to build anything. Mm-hmm. But I have to create opportunities for them to have the freedom to be able to if they wanted to build,
mm-hmm.
which is what we've done. And then all of the state laws that we're required to report on are all about making it easier for people to get through the process. Applications just aren't coming in. So okay. We're not doing anything. If we don't get to meeting our RENA, there is not a penalty per se. What ends up happening is there are sometimes the state will make laws that say if you didn't meet one or two of the different categories within your RENA, that maybe you now have to, that all your applications next year become ministerial. And cities don't like that because that means that, well, then they can't say no to something they don't like.
Right.
So who came up with the RENA allocation numbers? Like, how was that developed?
Yeah, so the state issues it, and then they issue an overall number.
Yeah.
And it's broken down into region.
Mm-hmm.
Then every regional planning area, which ABAG represents the 9 counties here, they then will divvy up that information and allocate it to every single jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
There is a huge committee through ABAG that's made up of a variety of people that help put that together. And then they will issue out those numbers. Cities can contest whatever their allocation is.
Mm-hmm.
You can try to appeal how it's determined, but what happens is they are able to come up with a methodology.
Mm-hmm.
And every regional planning area can come up with whatever their own methodology is. So the methodology that ABAG uses could be very different than what the SANBAG, which is the San Diego region, uses. Very different than what LA or whatever. So, but that's something that region has to approve, and then all those jurisdictions get their allocation.
Okay.
So we were assigned the 1,815.
And the breakdown.
And then it's statutory. So it's a statutory requirement that a certain percentage goes in each category. So, yeah, even the breakdown is determined by guidelines that are not made by the city. By any of the cities.
And acutely low is a new category, and that's why there's no allocation made at that time in 2022.
Yeah. So it's very possible for those, because all the different regions also have different housing element cycles. We're not all on the same timeline. So we have some regions that are now working on their 7th cycle. We're in our 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And so as new laws, there's things that they're required to do and report on that we're not. But when they make those laws, it impacts all the reports. So some things show up in our reports, but I don't have anything related to it. But it's in the report because another jurisdiction may have to report on that because they've had to update their housing element and had to include that information.
But there's no story here that's like, okay, we're kind of reaching capacity. Like we've done the big projects, we've done a lot of redevelopment of big sites, and there aren't that many more sites to redevelop, right? I mean, have we like kind of, you know what I mean? Like, do we just not have opportunities that people want to bid on? You know,
we
like,
do. So let me go back over here and show you guys.
Oh, it's that map with
the colors. And what happens if you don't meet that?
So if you actually don't produce the housing?
Yeah, that's just what it is.
It's just what it is.
Okay.
We did not meet our numbers last year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to housing here.
It's actually helpful to see how you navigate this and find the information because it's.
Oh, thanks. Sorry, that's not the one I want. I'll show you the map first. So, this is our site inventory map that shows all the sites that have been identified as vacant, underutilized,
mm-hmm.
Where we think there could be housing development. Or at the time that this was done, projects that we knew were in the process. So like this big red site down here, this is East Bay Bridge Shopping Center.
Well, the parking lots, basically.
So this has been identified in the general plan of a site to be redeveloped as mixed use that would have retail and housing. And with all that parking, it's deemed as a spot that's underutilized.
Absolutely.
Number 12 is the Powell Street Shopping Center. Same thing there. But that technically could be a site that could be redeveloped into something that had housing as a part of it.
The whole
shopping center. Site 13, that is our site B. That's the last large vacant parcel in the city. The city owns that.
Well, next to the train.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What is it right now? It's empty.
Yeah, because there's some contamination that's happening from another site that's impacting that site. So we have to wait for them to finish the remediation work on another site. So that we can continue to test that site and make sure that that site does not become contaminated.
Grass right now that they're not working on.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes you'll see maybe our public works put stuff over there, but that's it. But yeah, they're not working on it.
And they would never turn that into a park.
No. That is a housing. It's for housing. Yeah.
And what about the lot? Sorry, the lot that's next to it that has that's asphalt. That they sometimes had like a donation container in or something like that.
That might still be a part of our property. I don't know.
No.
So we do have sites. So that was one. And then the other part.
It's not like the best sites are gone, something.
So this is the listing of how did we identify that we could accommodate the 1,815 sites, and this is it. So this first site, this first page right here is all of our planned and approved residential developments that we knew were in the pipeline.
Right.
That accounted for those sites could have accommodated 330 units.
Mm-hmm.
We're saying 330. Those sites are saying it could have accommodated 623, but we believe 330 based on what we knew had been entitled.
Interesting.
Okay. And then the next section is our vacant and underutilized residential sites. And so you'll see Powell and Christie Avenue. That 5801, 5861, that's where the old Wells Fargo, that development is. That's that site. There's some properties on San Pablo that have been identified. And then if you go all the way down, you'll see of these vacant and underutilized, they could technically produce 3,034. Wow. We believe we actually could get 3,498. Now, looks like that's an error too. I don't know. I didn't put that together. But, and then we also, this past cycle was the first time we had to identify how many ADUs we thought could be developed because we don't know. So we said 30.
Yeah.
We're way past our 30 on ADUs. So this is where we believe, why we believe, yes, if all these sites got redeveloped, we could easily put another 1,800 units here in Emeryville.
Yeah, so it's still possible.
Yeah. So it is still, so we have sites available to make it happen. We need the market to change.
Okay.
Yeah, so the developers will want to come in and do it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Is the council going to ask this kind of question? I was, yeah.
To be honest, no. Because we don't actually, unless they ask for it, they typically waive presentation.
Oh,
we did presentation the first year. Since I've been here, I think we've only done it once. Usually they waive it.
Okay.
Yeah. So we don't usually present, and then they'll just, because it's gone through your committee, it'll go to planning commission.
And Valerie, these these new laws, like the acutely low, I'm assuming these aren't retroactive, right? So we can't go back in the books and see if, like, anything between July 2022 and 24, like, if anything under the new parameters of acutely low, like, we couldn't turn those gray, numbers into, like, actual numbers, because these laws are not retroactive, I'm assuming.
Like the 45.
So, no, we couldn't.
Okay.
And part of the reason is because we didn't have that as a defined term.
Got it.
So there wasn't anything that would have been written that talked about acutely low for there to have been a requirement for us to go back and see.
Okay.
Yeah. A good question. Okay. So, next slide here. Okay. Table C looks at sites that are identified in our housing element that we need to rezone in order to accommodate any shortfall that we have in our housing element. We don't have a shortfall, so we don't need to do any rezoning. I'm going to come back to Table D, but E, commercial development bonus approval. We didn't have any commercial projects that applied for development bonus in exchange for the production of affordable housing. There was nothing to identify there. Table F is about units that were rehab, preserved, and acquired for alternative adequate sites. We didn't have any sites that were substantially rehabbed from non-affordable to affordable, so we don't have anything to identify there. Table F2 is about above moderate income units that are converted to moderate income units. We did not have any existing multifamily deed restricted units, so there was nothing to identify there. Table G is locally owned land that is included in the housing sites inventory that was disposed of. We did not dispose of any land in 2025. Table H is locally owned surplus sites. We currently have 3 surplus sites that have been designated exempt surplus by the city council and has been accepted by the state. It's 3602 Avalon, 4300 San Pablo, and 5890. 5900 and 6150 Christie Avenue. If those units actually start construction, that's when we would dispose of them to the developer, and then we would identify them in Table G. Table J is student housing development that occurred with a density bonus. We did not have any student housing developments that came in 2025, so there was nothing to identify there. Table K, we're required to identify if we have a tenant preference policy. We do have a tenant preference policy. It's found in our planning regulations, so the reference is included in the report. The tenant preference policy has to do with when we have on our rental projects, there is a preference for people who live, work, or go to school in Emeryville.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is embedded into our regulations when someone's doing an affordable housing project, that there's a preference for them in that lottery or application process. Table L, this is a brand new table. It's about historical resources. We're supposed to identify if we added any new sites to the National Register of Historic Places, the California Register of Historic Places, or we designated it through our own regulations. We did not have any sites that were identified. And then the last tab is a LEAP reporting. That's a local economic assistance planning grant, I believe is what it stands for. We did receive $65,000 to assist with the development of our 2023-2031 housing element. All of those funds have been expended and reimbursed, but we are still required to report on it every year throughout the housing cycle. So then I'm going to go back to Table D.
So before we dive into Table D, because there's a lot here, just wanted to ask, there's so much, I mean, so much work here. Are you doing all of this yourself? Okay.
This report, yes, I do the whole report. I run a bunch of reports. Emily helped me this time and tried to help me figure out. I was like, because I'm writing narratives on 144 objections.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I get data from staff. So staff does give me data. Mm-hmm. I then have to turn that into the format for the report.
Okay.
But yes. And then Navarre Oaks, who is our long range planner, they also help with this but at the same token, I'm working on housing element. They're working on the general plan annual report because they both are due April 1st. And they both have to be submitted. So we kind of worked collaboratively because a lot of the information that I'm pulling has to go in their report as well.
I see.
So we work together on a lot of this, but I kind of lead the bulk of getting this part done since they're working on the general plan, which takes in way more than housing. It's about transportation and urban design and climate. And it's like they have like 8 or 10 chapters they have to report on. So that's a huge lift as well.
Yes.
But it's not like, I mean, I don't know. It just feels like, could use some more staff capacity, right, for more support for all of this. It's so massive.
I'm still working on ways to make it easier. I have not totally figured it out yet. I mean, I think I've gotten it easier than it was, but part of the challenge sometimes comes in that the state changes the reporting form.
Yeah.
And I think I've mentioned this to you guys last time. You know, the training for the new reporting was January 22nd.
It's not enough time. Yeah.
Now, from their standpoint, it's not due till April 1st. But our process requires it to go to these three committees or two committees and then city council. And in order to make that work, that means I have to have this report done in January.
Yeah.
So I have
like a week.
Right. So what it does is it just constrains my time. Mm-hmm. You know, other jurisdictions, they may not go and have it done until March, but I'm constrained by time because we have to go to these other committees.
But these requirements, I'm assuming, are formulated with, you know, a certain size of city in mind. And we are probably much smaller than that, particularly in terms of our city's staff. So it's like a real disadvantage to have to cover the same amount of ground and the same requirements that larger cities do with a much smaller staff.
However, I totally agree with you. I could not imagine doing those housing tables A and A2 being in a large city like in Oakland, who has hundreds and thousands of units. Like when we were working on just our little 6 or 8 like cross-referencing things, it was driving me crazy. I'm like, why can't I find this address? Where is it? I couldn't imagine having to do that with thousands of addresses. Every application that's come in, you got to report on.
Yeah.
Everything that's out there in progress, like that's a lot. So there's pros and cons to large and big cities, but yes, and they did change Table D this year. They've done that, I think, to make it more user-friendly, but also something that is much more substantial and that follows similar processes across cities. Before, we used to report on all the programs. Now, they want us to report on every action. Now, had we known that, we wouldn't have had 144 actions in our plan.
Mm-hmm.
If we knew we had to report on 100, every single one.
And through Z and AA through ZZ or whatever, that's the action.
Had we know, but again, at that time, so next time we now know.
So this is the first year that you've had to report.
Last year they required us to report on objectives too.
Okay.
This is the second year on objectives. But what they've also added is they've tried to standardize the status. So now they have a drop down for us to pick on what the status is.
Mm-hmm.
And there's four options: not started, in progress, complete, and continuous. Okay. Continuous is something that you just always do. So that's the distinction between that and in progress.
Right.
They also require us to identify for every objective a quantified metric. And they have a drop down that you can pick from for that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to enter in the number. So how many of that quantified metric did you actually meet?
Mm-hmm.
And they now have a new requirement for us to identify where a link to where you can find support to prove what you're saying.
But most of these do not have quantified metrics associated with them, right?
No. A lot of us, no.
And it wouldn't make sense to in a lot of cases.
Now we know. So those who are working on their next housing element, they now know. So now they can design their housing element to accommodate the way they're, mm-hmm. you're supposed to report. But we're in the middle, so it's like I can't go back. So, like,
right.
it's written the way it is. And they also require us to identify the timeline. And the state has created a new Office of Enforcement that will go out and check on people. When they read the housing element annual reports and they see things aren't happening, they potentially could set up a meeting, talk to that city about what's going on. They could issue an action letter saying you need to do X, Y, and Z, or you now need to provide me with a plan as to why you haven't done these things that were in your housing element that you said you would do by this date, and now we're past it.
Will they?
The state.
Oh, the state.
Yeah. Okay. Housing and Community Development. Department. There's a compliance office now. So in our housing element, we had 5 goals, 19 policies, 47 programs, 144 objective actions. So as I said, 66 of our objective actions are continuous. 22 of them have been completed, 31 are in progress, and 25 have not started. So I'm not going through all 144. I've picked quite a few to just walk us through so you guys can understand. So program A is our housing development regulatory program. There's 3 objective actions within that. The first one is to implement various housing development regulatory programs to ensure the construction of housing that's being built for all income levels. So that's our affordable housing program. The continuous objective action, we'll always have it as a part of our planning regulations. And so we continue to inform all applicants of this process and our development bonus program, as well as the state's density bonus program and our affordable housing program. But again, there were no residential developments that were entitled or submitted in 2025. The second objective action is to evaluate the feasibility of modifying our affordable housing program to increase the number of new affordable ownership residential units, to incorporate an inclusionary housing requirement into our ordinance and increase the number of affordable rental units that are designated for extremely low and developmentally disabled to increase the creation of additional residential units for those groups.
Mm-hmm.
That is in progress. So the City Council did approve a contract with our consultant this year. They did do the kickoff back in August. They are underway. With this project, when they get to the point of having recommendations related to the affordable housing program, that will come back to this committee. And then the third one is to analyze and update the percentage of affordable housing units required under the city's development bonus program in response to changes made to the affordable housing program. So that hasn't started yet because we haven't gotten the analysis on what changes to make to the affordable. So that's why that one is red. So that's just, it's contingent. So it won't start until we complete that other phase.
Is there a projected completion date?
Yeah, we missed it.
Oh.
We had put in the housing element that this would be something that would be done by 2024. We don't know what we were thinking. That wasn't going to happen. So right now, it's a year and a half process on that second objective. They started in August, so it's quite a bit of work that has to be done. So it'll take a little bit of time to get to that point.
Through that year and a half, or
yeah, a year and a half, will they be giving feedback to the audit, or they're just going to give a final?
No, we meet with the staff, meets with them. Staff meets with them, and so on little, there's milestones and things that they have to share and data that they're that they give to us. So, yeah. Okay, so go to the next one. Another program I picked was Program I, preservation of our BMR ownership portfolio. So the first objective was to issue our Measure C housing bonds to support BMR, our BMR acquisition program. That was complete. We sold the bonds in 2023. That money is available for us to acquire BMR units when necessary to prevent foreclosure or to prevent the loss from our portfolio. The second objective was to acquire BMR units that are at risk of losing their affordability restriction and resell them to affordable sales price. That's a continuous. The money is available. So as we come across properties that are going through foreclosure or that will lose their affordability restriction, we have the ability to go in and buy it. We did not buy any units in 2025. I think the last time we bought one was in 23. The third one is to ensure compliance of our BMR ownership portfolio by ensuring our homeowners continue to occupy the units as their principal place of residency. Again, this is a continuous objective. Our BMR owner occupancy monitoring letters were sent out in 2025. 86% of the homeowners, which is 182, did confirm and submitted the required document to confirm their occupancy after the initial request. The remaining households had until February of 2026 to confirm their occupancy. And then the fourth objective was to ensure that each BMR ownership unit is marketed in compliance with our resale restrictions and sold to an income-eligible home buyer. That's also a continuous objective, something we always do. We had two BMR ownership units that were put on the market for resale in compliance with our BMR resale marketing guidelines and restrictions in 2025. Program EE is resident engagement. So we had two objectives. This is our shining star. So this was the evaluation of all of our committee and commission memberships to see if the membership is reflective of the socioeconomic and racial mix of our city and if there were any missing voices. So that committee membership evaluation, it started in 2024. It was complete in 2025. The city council has received that and had made the recommended changes to the committees in regards to collecting data in regards to people's socio and economic status in the racial mix. So that is complete. And then the second objective was to investigate the restructuring of the housing committee to ensure that the committee has at least one member that resides in a BMR unit, one member that is a tenant, one member who is a homeowner. That restructuring was approved by the city council also in 2025. So when they do the next application period, which I guess is probably come out late April, maybe early May, that's something that they'll be looking for to make sure that they are filling those seats. And then Program LL is our planning regulation amendments. This one has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Did I count that right? Eight different objectives. Each one of them is related to a. Can I be seen? Okay. Each one of them is related to a. A change in our planning regulations that we need to make in order to comply with state law. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are not necessarily applicable to things that come our way. They're not necessarily things that we've asked to do, but they are things that there has been a change in state law and we are required to adopt it. So for the first six, they are all in progress. They went to the Planning Commission in November of 2025 and they recommended approval. It'll go to the city. It actually went to the city council in January and was approved. That happened after 25. So that's why it's still in progress and not complete. So next year we'll show complete. The last two require general plan amendments. And the last two are actually planning regulation amendments that the city wanted to make. They didn't come from the state. So those require general plan amendments, which means we have to do a tribal consultation. Tribal consultation process takes 90 days. And so that is in progress. They're anticipating going back to the Planning Commission in April in order to get their recommendation and approval of this, and then we'll go to City Council after that. So those two, while they have not started yet, or at least they had not started in 2025, as of today, they have started the process of doing those other two objective actions. And then I think I have one more here. And then our affordable housing platform. So we had three objectives related to that. So we were going to continue to coordinate with the Alameda County on the design and implementation of their affordable housing portal. I was on the working group committee for this. And so that actually has been completed. Their portal had launched. I think it launched at some point in 2023. However, it has ceased. So that portal, as well as the portal that was created in San Mateo and San Jose, have all been merged, thank you, into a regional portal, which is called Doorway.
Mm-hmm.
That regional, I think the only county that's not on there, I believe, is San Francisco. They mm-hmm. still have their Dahlia portfolio, mm-hmm. and it's managed separately. So, but everybody else has merged into this one, mm-hmm. so that instead of a resident who's looking for housing going to every county's portal, and Contra Costa didn't have one at all, you could now just go to one portal for the entire region.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we are. So the second one was to support also the development of those two things. We're working in tandem at the same time. I was on both working groups. So I do still participate in that. The city continues to participate in the steering group, the working group steering committee. We had three BMR rental properties in Emeryville that were advertised through Doorway. One that provided 47 available affordable units, and two BMR properties advertised open wait lists for four affordable units.
Mm-hmm.
Between those, what is that, between those five properties, there were over 4,000 people that applied to either for the wait list or for the units.
Mm-hmm. Wait, say that again.
There were over 4,000 people that applied.
Right.
For either the two properties that have opened their wait list or the three properties that have available affordable units.
So these two things combined, like incredible demand for these mm-hmm. units, and we don't have more in the pipeline at the moment, are not a good combination.
I will say of the 47 units, 45 of those were Nellie Henning Gateway. The other two were affordable units that the developers had exhausted their wait list, and so they opened mm-hmm. those units because they were actually vacant. The other properties opened their wait list because they realized that their wait list numbers were getting down. So they want to go ahead and get more people on their wait list so that when a unit becomes available, they can just go to the wait list. So that's the distinction as to why a property may put one unit out there. And then the last thing was we modify our affordable housing covenant and BMR rental policy guidelines to require the utilization of the affordable housing portal that we've been working on. It wasn't previously in our policy because it didn't exist. So we wanted to make sure that our developers are utilizing this portal to advertise their units, just because you can see the mass amount of applications and needs that's out there. But it makes it a one-stop shop for somebody looking for affordable housing. You can now go to one website instead of having to piecemeal through all these other processes to find it.
The website is called Doorway?
It's the Doorway Housing Portal. And there is a link on our website directly to it. You can register. And the good thing about it is that when you register to it, it'll send you notifications based off of the areas that you want to receive notices about. And then it also has a comment application. So everything that's in there, so it's not like you're filling out. There are little nuanced differences that will happen, but there's a comment app, and it'll save your information so you're not having to pull all kind of things every single time.
You can apply within five clicks.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, is this data available? I'm sure it is to builders. Like, if they saw that, yeah, like what would
like who applied?
Or to like bring in builders to develop BMR units. Like, is this available? Like, if they knew, like, there's 4,000, you know, so many companies looking for housing, and that they would be able to fill their housing. Not saying that they would necessarily want to fill it with BMR tenants, but that, like, if there was some incentive for them to do that, like, is that available information to them?
I don't know. I mean, right now we're able to get it for reporting purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that if there's a dashboard out there that they put related to that,
mm-hmm.
Just for the public to see how many applications are out there. I don't know that it's been put out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say there has been some concern, while it is great to have this one-stop shop,
mm-hmm.
there is also the other side of it of somebody having to go through 4,000 applications that has become an issue.
Yeah.
That some developers are like, I don't want to do that because it's now creating an additional capacity for me. And so we're constantly tweaking, trying to revise, trying to figure out how can we make it easier? How can we make it better? Or do we need to make certain kind of changes so that's not problematic?
And does the doorway provide features like that for the users? Like for the apartment owners that are going through all these applications, are they, how can they even sort or prioritize or go through them? Because I know in a lot of the applications, mm-hmm. they ask for certain details about the person applying.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if that's like going into a point system and who is getting all that.
When it comes to the preferences,
yeah.
all of that is filtered out in what mm-hmm. will be provided to the developer.
Mm-hmm. So they get the filtered information.
Mm-hmm.
So
they'll get the whole raw data, but it'll be filterable so that they can see of all the information that was collected so that you could then sort or based on that. And then also when they run the lottery, all of that information is there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So those are the programs. If there's a program that I didn't talk about, or I'm sorry, an objective that was in the report that you want to ask me about,
I had a couple.
Yeah.
Because this is actually really helpful to kind of like see it lined up like this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask about program Q. It's related to another item later on the agenda, but this is the housing for artists. So I'm glad to see that it's in here to assess the housing needs of artistic community, and that it's listed as something that's like a midterm objective, so it's kind of perfect, like it's going to be in the next year or two. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's good that we're talking about it now, because that's actually probably what's coming up. The other piece on this, though, on Q that was interesting was there's this program, right, to essentially for BMR live-work units to market them first, or I think that's the idea, like market them first to artists because they're live work, right? And BMR.
So is it the educate existing owners of live work units about the availability of the home buyer down payment assistance? No.
That was interesting too, but I'm two rows down from there.
Promote housing designs and mixed uses.
One above that. Conduct targeted marketing for artists, craftspersons, and BMR live work units become available.
Mm-hmm.
And it does say that a BMR live work unit did become available in 2025, but no targeted marketing took place due to staff capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So what would the target, like, I don't know, can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so there was a unit at Farcom Powell that actually is designated as a live-work unit, and they had exhausted their wait list. So that's one of the units that went into the housing portfolio for people to apply for.
I see.
And so because we put it into the portal, we have not worked on developing any specific marketing plans yet. So that's why it was just the one unit. It went into the portal. I will say they did have a challenge trying to fill it because they got applicants, but they didn't get applicants who had a business license.
Yeah,
you have to have a business license because it's a lived work unit. So it took them a while, but they finally did find somebody who was able to go into that unit. But it is one of the things, there are several categories where we talk about developing targeted marketing plans, and we just have not focused on marketing plans at all yet. And part of it is just because there's not a huge demand of units. So putting that time in developing a big policy for when a unit, but it's something that we need to work on. So my hope is that it's something that we'll work on this year, figuring out what's the best way to market to different groups.
I think that's great. And it's a little bit related to P right above it. So this is the Live Work Units program here. And I think it is interesting. So in the second piece under Live Work Units, the one about educating existing owners, that first sentence there is really interesting. The city advertises the availability of affordable housing programs on the Rotten City Cultural District website. So that's like a way to market, right? Particularly to artists that the city is doing. But I just went there and all the links are broken.
That's because the city changed its
Exactly. So like there is a way to market to artists that you already have set up, but I think it's and the other problem is that it just provides links to we can talk about this in the future, but I think there are some ways to make use of that Rotten City Cultural District website database network in regards to this that are specifically about live work units, right, for artists.
So funny enough, on this report, because they asked us last year to provide links, but not for everything. So it was a part of our narrative. And the way that the report works is you can download last year's data so that you don't have to retype everything, right?
Yeah.
All of the links, none of the links work because they're from our old website.
Right.
So I had to go in and find the new link for every single thing. So we're still finding places where that has happened. We are very well aware there's a lot of places links are broken and they don't work anymore. So I will remind Amber about that, that's something we need to get fixed. So when you guys see that stuff, tell us, because we find out about them all the time and you're just like,
So if I do find out about those, I should write to like you and Amber, or...
I mean, wherever it is, you can tell me and then I'll pass it on to whoever's page or whoever's working on that. And so that they can, she needs to notify the owner of that website to change its updates.
It seems like those two things of like, you know, targeted marketing towards artists and we've got the Rotten City Cultural District website and database, like putting those two together seems like a good way to go.
Email housing, since that's an easy.
There's a housing email. Yeah, definitely send it there.
I'm curious, and I was just looking over. I didn't get a chance. But I'm looking at R right now, and I'm curious about the trajectory for that, for the family housing. I feel like I've seen there's a lot of families.
So the second one, the research options to expand regulatory.
Well, both.
So the first one's already been, that one has already happened. So let me go through here. Okay. So the first one is about promoting housing design. So that's a continuous thing. That's something we always will do. It's in our when we modified our objective standards, that also required us to update our design guidelines, which includes our family friendly regulations. So that is something that's out there. That's an example of a development standard that they could get a waiver and a concession on of not following family friendly. So that is already there. So we continuously, when we get projects, no projects came in, so we don't have anybody to enforce that kind of requirement. The second one is about researching options to expand regulatory incentives to encourage development of larger units. So how do we get more 3 and 4 bedrooms? That is something that's a part of Program A about our affordable housing program and looking at, are there changes that we can make to incentivize more or requiring more units? We don't know if that'll be the case, if there is an ability of doing that. So it might end up, it could end up resulting in, yes, we're doing that, or it might be like, well, no, there's no way for you to incentivize more. I don't know.
Your incent, like if you had an agreement with a developer, would that override their ability to submit for waivers? Like if you guys come to an agreement, they could, you know, to...
create that type of housing, they couldn't then.
If it's a financial incentive, then they could not get the waiver for it. But if it's a regulatory incentive, then they probably could. Probably could. And then let me see. I think it's just those two, right?
Yeah.
Can you give me an example of a financial incentive and a regulatory incentive?
A financial incentive would be me providing them with money to build something. A regulatory incentive would be them getting like an increase in their in the amount of their density or their FARs so that they can build more than whatever they're restricted to do. That would be like a regulatory incentive. Or maybe they get so.
Isn't density the same as a financial?
No. Mm-mm. That's a regulatory, that's not an actual exchange of money. It's about what they're allowed to now build.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I have one more question. When you say exhausted wait list, what deems a unit on a wait list application exhausted?
So they've gone to everybody who was sitting waiting and reached out to them, and either they weren't interested or there was no response, and so now they don't have a certain number of people remaining on the wait list, or they can have nobody on it.
How many phone calls is like one?
No, usually they, so there's the, most of the properties are supposed to send out some type of notification. Usually it's by email saying, are you still interested in being on this wait list? So that they can work on one purging.
Yeah.
Because part of the issue that we come across is people are like, well, I've been on this wait list for 10 years.
Yeah.
Even still meet or want the unit, I don't know. So they're supposed to try to purge that wait list or at least try to reach out.
Mm-hmm.
If the person responds back saying yes, they are, then they remain on the wait list if they're not. But you could have people, we could have, let's say, like on that one situation, the people who were on the wait list for a live work, there might not be anybody remaining. They still might have plenty of people on their wait list for their other BMR units.
Yeah.
Or it could be I have people who are interested in the 3-bedroom, but what I have available is the studio. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you have to go back out because your wait list doesn't, the people on your wait list don't meet the kind of unit you're trying to fill.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if there could be like something like as far as when you fill out an application and it's just like a technical thing on the site where you say, once you fill this out and within 2 months or every 2 months or every 3 months, you have to look at your application. See the status, or unless you get a call, and then you have to say, yes, I'd like to resubmit. Yes, I'd like to resubmit. No, I don't want to resubmit.
Well, once you're on the wait list, you're there, unless they call you to say, are you still interested, which only should happen once a year. Because I think it would be my thought would be, it would be a very onerous burden to put it on a tenant to every couple of months, say yes or no.
It would.
So right now, the thought is that, you know, once you're on that wait list, it's a year. That they're supposed to reach out to you, and it's by email. Some of them will call. Some of them will do more than just an email. They may call you as well.
Mm-hmm. Like I was on the wait list for 2 years, and on the second year they call.
That's great.
Yeah, and I missed the first call.
Sure.
Then they called again.
Oh, wow.
So, so it took like a really long time, but I had even forgot. I'd forgotten that I applied to it because you apply so many and you never hear back and you're waiting. And then when they call you, it's like, oh,
yes. I know numbers.
Because you're one of 4,000.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So it's really,
They only call no email.
It was a long time.
It was a long time.
Oh.
And that part too, things have changed over time as to how what information was collected and how they did it. We used to require developers to send out a letter to everybody who was on their interest list. We don't do that anymore. To actually send out mail because email is so prevalent. Like, you know.
Yeah, because when it gets lost, it gets in your neighbor.
The letter can get lost. It's junk. Nobody's opening it. You know.
But the letter was mailed, and then the letter was open. It wasn't a note or anything. It was
Okay.
Okay. So related to the housing element, next steps is we're here tonight. Again, it goes to the Planning Commission on February 19th, City Council on March 17th, so that we can submit it by the deadline on April 1st. Mm-hmm. So the action that I'm requesting of you guys is to recommend that the City Council approve and submit the housing element. I will say there will be some small tweaks that we will continue to make over the next month or two. Emily was working on spelling mistakes for me today because it's in Excel. The spelling function is disabled, so you cannot check it. Mm-hmm. And so, like, yeah, there's little tweaks and stuff, but the report really is, the numbers are what they are.
Yeah. I do feel that it's the story it's telling to me is like, we are doing everything we can at the city to make as much affordable housing available as possible, to preserve it, to get more in there, into the pipeline, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But that the market is hurting us really bad for a couple of years here. And I do think that we shouldn't just, you know, say that's okay. Like, I don't know whether there are things that we can do, or maybe we have a conversation at some point about, like, how can we try to, I don't know, balance out or compensate for some of those market issues. What kind of, like, I mean, what can we do? Because, like, the 6-6 versus, like, hundreds in like, 2023 is just, it looks dismal. And it's not because we're not doing a lot of work or we don't have the right policies. Like, what else can we do there?
So there is one.
Okay.
It's one of the requirements in this last cycle that the state made us do is we have to identify non-governmental constraints that are impeding residential development.
Yeah.
So it's a required program. And so our objective related to that was to identify actions that may help reduce constraints to development if they're due to non-governmental constraints, and then work proactively with stakeholders to identify and develop any considerations related to that. So our status related to that was there's no action to remove non-governmental constraints have been identified on the local level. This is where I have help answering this one. As current non-governmental constraints are macroeconomic issues that require interventions on the state and federal level, as the market has not adjusted.
Okay, that's the only way you can do the basic.
Well, how do we get developers? Like, are properties marketed in places? Mm-hmm. Do you guys invite? Like, have you guys ever done like open bidding? How do you guys?
So if it's a city property, we do an open request for proposals. Mm-hmm. But if it's just a property like the old Wells Fargo that's privately owned, that's on the market.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they emailed me asking me if, as the city, if we're interested in buying it. Like, no, a developer needs to back that, you know. But they're all marketed. They're out there. It's just about finding a developer who sees the vision or is interested in building that, can get the financing, is willing to put up the money. Mm-hmm. That Wells Fargo site, there have been two planning applications for it. It's a ton of money that goes into putting together a planning application for a development project. So there's been two proposals on them. They both have expired and haven't moved forward.
Mm-hmm.
But we had two different developers at different times looking at that site to develop it into. One of them was housing. The other one is housing and life science.
Do you have a sense for why those applications, stalled?
I think it's financial. They realized that it wasn't going to work, whatever it was that they were attempting to do at that time, that they couldn't move it forward.
But maybe that like looking into those kind of cases might be helpful, where it's like, okay, we have interest. Why isn't it working out for them financially? And like,
that's right.
Is it transportation related? Oh, good enough access to that. I don't know what it could be, but like
for that specific site, I think there are a lot of things that can make it a little challenging.
Okay.
They're required to build a park also on that site.
Hmm.
So
some of the entitlements are required.
Some of our requirements that's in our general plan for it to be a future. So that site has to have a park on it. Okay. So whenever you're building there, you're building that
and there has to be space set aside for a park.
Mm-hmm.
I think the last developer was interested in doing life science. Well, our requirements require you to do housing. Mm-hmm. So you have to put housing and life science. And so then the question is, okay, well, that means I got to build two separate buildings on this site. And I still have to do the park.
Right.
And, you know, and how do I make all that work?
Which is good and beautiful, but it's about finding the right person.
Well, in financing and whether or not they can do it. And the life science industry is not what it used to be. We had tons of life science buildings that were built here.
Interesting.
But they're not occupied, but they were built.
So,
and so now here, yeah. Like, here's another developer. I'm like, you're trying to build another one?
Yeah.
Like, do we really need it? But there was money available to do that at one point in time.
Right, right.
So we need the market to shift again. To where now there's money to do residential development.
Yeah. Wish I meant keeping the park. I'm glad that that is being prioritized.
Well, I guess my other question too, earlier on, like, keeping with the same vein of just like solutions, when this information goes to the state, right? So it's not just Emeryville, they get
they get
everyone, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious, the body that gets all this intel. What do they do it? Do they do what you just did, right? They take a look at it and they're like, oh, there's like an issue here. Is there opportunities for like outreach if the writing on the wall is economic at the state and federal level?
We foresee this with all everybody.
So yeah, like is there engagement maybe with they have like roundtable discussions about, because they won't just see the Emeryville, they'll see I'm sure they'll start seeing the trend.
I was thinking another thing too, the grassroots way of students, you know, you call the title company and you get a farm. It's super like 1920s, but I mean.
I plugged it in, but.
Oh, no.
I know. I can get it to restart again. Yes, it's restarting.
Mm-hmm. How much do the cities like work with the state, or do they even work with each other or communicate on these things?
They just direct.
Cities submit their reports to the state.
Whether they want to show up to the party or not,
they read it and then they'll come back and ask questions. And you have to give them some kind of answer. And I think sometimes it's just about them documenting that they've checked and asked, even if they understand kind of like what the issue is.
But could the city like go to the state and ask for involvement in terms of like
the legislature?
Funding. Yeah. So HCD is only the state agency that takes direction from the state's legislature. So it's like,
yeah.
A lot of this goes back to like what the Senate and Assembly want to do.
Because a lot of even the new requirements are coming from the state legislature saying, oh, this is what you're going to do or how you're going to do it. And they create laws for the entire state,
right?
Not the micro regions and what's going on.
Yeah.
Wanted to have more money, it would take an assemblyman or a senator and they'll allocate for funding, and HCD can implement that program. Just that's how that would work.
Yeah.
And our reps here are the former fleet mayor.
Yeah.
What's his name?
His last name begins with an A, I think.
Yes.
Alguin?
And all the transportation stuff to it. Jesse,
Arguin.
But these are the people who we'd have to
talk
to.
Okay. So we do have one more action, but this was the recommendation I'm hoping that you guys will provide us today.
I motion that we present this to the city council for them to approve and submit the housing element 2025 annual progress report.
Is there a second?
Second.
Vote. Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Member Drummond?
Aye.
Member Johnson?
Yes.
Member Jessup?
Aye.
Member Medeiros?
Aye. We've got a side note that says an extension for Valerie.
I wish I did ask. I was like, I have to go in February. Could I wait till March? They were like, no, because it goes to housing before it goes to planning commission.
It's really soon.
Yeah.
It does.
Okay. So our second action item is our housing successor annual report. So some background on that. The housing successor agency is responsible for housing functions and assets of the former redevelopment agency. The housing successor agency is tasked with enforcing all the housing covenants and restrictions and exercising any power, rights, obligations related to the low and moderate income housing fund. The city, which is the successor agency of the Emeryville Redevelopment Authority, must provide an annual report on the housing assets and activities of the housing successor agency to the state in conjunction with the general plan by April 1st. So this report is also submitted with the housing element and the general plan. So this is an accounting of what we're doing with the assets and the money. So they have a form, they have a requirement as to what you're required to report on. So each of these are the required sections. So section one, how much money do we receive from loans that were taken out against our assets? We don't have any, we didn't have any, so no. How much money was deposited in our low mod income housing asset fund for the fiscal year, which is 24, July 1st, 2024 to June 30th, 2025, it was a little over $436,000. The ending balance of that fund at the end of the fiscal year was about $20.1 million. What did we spend our money on in the fiscal year? We only spent $4,055, and that was spent on monitoring and admin. It was actually spent on the auditor, for the audit. What is the value of the assets that are owned by the housing successor agency? The total value of our assets is a little over $38 million. $17.9 million is related to real value of property, that's our assets that are owned. And then $20 million is related to the values of loans and grant receivables that we have outstanding that people owe us money on that we've lent in the past. Did we have any transfer of our assets during the fiscal year? We did not.
Can we back up just a second? Mm-hmm. Why do we have, why do we need to maintain the balance at like 20 million? What is that for in the future? If it's, this is the former redevelopment agency, are we going to be, what are we going to be doing with that 20 million?
We would spend it. We have to spend it on affordable housing.
Oh, we can. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
We
can. Why it didn't go to the other programs, was it? Or the other?
Mm. Why we didn't have. So the city uses general fund for homeless prevention and rapid rehousing. We don't use this pool of money. And then we didn't have any housing development projects that were spending money. The last project, and it's later in the report, but like Nellyhan and Gateway had some of this money, but we don't have any other major housing development projects. So there's no money to allocate it to.
Same problem with, okay.
Yeah. It's all related. wrong way. Okay, so what projects does the city currently get tax revenue on that were housing successor assets? And that is the Emmy. That project was completed, I think, in 2015. But we do get tax revenue specifically from this, from that project. And then what is the status of any property that was acquired after February 1st, 2012 by the Redevelopment Authority? Mm-hmm. Redevelopment Authority went away, I think it was at the end of 2012. So you'll see we purchased four properties all by the deadline of August 31st, 2012, which I believe is right before the redevelopment authorities went away. So we're required to report on what we're doing with those assets. So they were all acquired in August of 2012. There was a statutory deadline that we must initiate development by September 1st, 2022. The first project, that 3706 San Pablo, that's Estrella Vista project. That project is complete. The 3602 Avalon, that asset we have put out for redevelopment twice. It is currently on the market for sale. And then the last two relate to our Christie site development. That project went out for an RFP. We've selected a developer. It has been entitled. So we met the initiate development deadline, but that's the status, and we'll have to report on these every year till they go away. Actually, I probably could have taken Astoria Vista off here. No, I don't. I think I have to leave it on here.
And so could you stick like an ADU on Adeline? Is that what they're looking to do? What are they looking to sell it for?
It's on the market for whatever somebody wants to do. They are going to have to meet the zoning and land use requirements of not only Emeryville, but of Oakland, because it's two pieces of property. One is actually in Oakland. The other one is in Emeryville. The Emeryville component actually sits behind the neighbor's house.
That's a good thing.
It's the backyard of the neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. The lot that you see from the street is actually the Oakland property.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
So you could build a house on that. Somebody could do an ADU. But yeah, we have it on the market for sale. And in fact, we just did a price reduction from $200,000, I think, to $150,000 for that lot. Okay, next part. So we have to describe our outstanding inclusionary replacement housing obligations. We had two redevelopment areas here. One was our 1976 area. I don't know what that is. And the other one is the Shell Mound area. There were requirements. So before we transitioned everything from the redevelopment authority to the housing successor, we had a surplus of 45 units that were developed for low and moderate income units. And we had a surplus of 37 units that were for very low income units. So in the 1976, we didn't have any obligations that were passed over to the housing successor because we had surpassed the requirements. In the Shell Mound area, we did have a deficit of 5 units in low and mod income, but we had a surplus in the very low income of 27. So that deficit of 5 is wiped away by the surplus for the lower income category. So again, we did not have any obligations that transitioned over to us.
Is 1976 the year of the building, maybe?
No, it was a designated area, but I don't know why it was called that.
When
I
mean,
was
that?
I don't know that either.
Because we don't do anything based on those designated areas anymore. I don't know. Because again, that was all redevelopment, so that stuff ended in 2012. But I saw them report it.
Yeah.
Okay. X is our extremely low income housing test. This test requires us to look back at the past. I think it's 4 or 5 years. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The past 5 years. And look to see whether or not we met the requirements of expending at least 30% of whatever our expenditures were on units set aside for 30% and below, and whether or not we exceeded or not, we needed to max out at 20% of the money being spent on units for households between 60 and 80%. So when you look at the past 5 years and what we spent money on, we spent money on the Estrella Vista project and our Nellie Hannon Gateway project, and we spent $5.9 million. 49% of the money that was put into those projects benefited units that were set aside for households below 30%. So we exceeded the requirement there. And then you can see within the 50% of AMOT, there's not a specific requirement there, but 11% of our money went to units for 50% and below. 41% of our money went to units between 51 and 60. And so we actually didn't have any units that we spent money on that were targeted to 61 and 80. So again, we met the compliance requirement.
Again, this is all 2023 or earlier. Right.
Yes.
I mean, there's nothing in the last 2 years, right?
No.
So, yeah.
Now, even the money we spent on San Pablo, we put this money in the project early. So they got other money from the city, but we put this pool of money in early on, even though it just finished construction now. So we did spend other money on it, just not from this funding. Senior housing test. So we have to look at whether or not we produced any senior housing within the past 10-year period, mm-hmm. and whether or not we exceed 10%, because you cannot develop more than 10% of your housing within a 10-year period cannot be just for seniors. And the purpose of this is to ensure that people aren't saying, oh, I build affordable housing, but everything you build is for seniors, because that's usually easier and more palatable to get approved. It's about making sure you're building a variety of housing stock. So when we look at all the housing that was developed over the past 10 years, these are all of those developments. It was 235 restricted units that were built, and none of those units were senior housing. So we did not exceed that 10% requirement, so we're in compliance. The next test is our excess surplus test. And Emily has learned, because Emily worked on this report, I hate this requirement. So for the excess surplus, we have to look and see, as we are getting money paid back to us, are we putting the money out? Mm-hmm. And the test is to look at what our unencumbered funds are, and then also to look at what deposits we've received. So you can look back and see in 21 and 22, we were getting over $900,000 in repayments mm-hmm. loans. It has slowed for the 23-24 year, and again in the 24-25 year, we're not getting as many people paying off their loans, so we're not generating as much revenue. Mm-hmm. So the total deposits over the past 4 years is $2.8 million. We have about $1.6 million in unencumbered funds. The test is looking to see whether or not our unencumbered funds are greater than our deposits, and they are not. So we do not have excess surplus. We have had excess surplus before. What is required when you do is that you have to develop a plan as to how you're going to spend money in over a 3-year period.
I feel like you're getting me ready to do my taxes here. Yeah. It's like you very much like an IRS form.
And I think too, like as far as like the 22-23, then we were still like in the process of because of COVID, you know. Well, people didn't have to pay.
No. So what happened? The reason that it was so much because during COVID, there was a huge housing boom of home ownership. People were buying houses.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of people selling their houses and moving somewhere else and then buying. And when they sell, they're required to pay off their loan to the city. And so that's why we had so much then. Right now, things have just slowed and people aren't selling their houses as quickly, which is why we don't have a lot of houses on the market.
Stagnant.
So, but remember, we had a couple slides ago, I think there was $19, $20 million worth of outstanding loan. So we're always going to get money coming in, and we have to do this until all the money is gone. So we're going to be reporting on this forever. But some of these loans are like 75-year loans, so it'll be a long period of time. And then there's one more slide here. We have to report on our inventory of our home ownership units assisted. You are correct. We were supposed to do rehab. I went and did some more research. So we have a total of 151 units in our portfolio that were funded through the redevelopment agency. That includes our home ownership units and our units that were owner-occupied that we provided rehab funding to. In 2025, we had 0 units go into foreclosure, but we did have 2 units pay off their loans. Mm-hmm. No money was returned to the successor agency, but we did receive $104,800 related to those 2 loan repayments. The other deposits that the city got was related to larger rental development loans payments, but only 2 homeowner loans paid off. And then we utilize Hello Housing to do the management of our portfolio and keep up with that. And so, again, we're here tonight. Go to the Planning Commission on the 19th, City Council March 17th, and then the requirements to submit it by April 1st. And so we're hoping that you guys will recommend that the City Council approve and submit the housing successor.
I make a motion that we recommend the City Council to approve and submit the 2024/25 Housing Successor Annual Progress Report.
I'll second.
Okay, for the roll, I will do Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Member Drummond.
Aye.
Member Jessup.
Aye.
Member Johnson.
Aye.
Member Matera. And that passes. Okay. We don't have any information items tonight. Future agenda items. The next report we'll be doing our Housing Advisory Committee annual report. So we'll talk about what we've accomplished over the past year and then what we want to focus on and prioritize over the next year. And then we will also have coming up, hopefully, I'm proposing that it'll come in April, is our fiscal year 25 affordable housing expenditure plan, our Measure C housing bond annual report, and our affordable housing annual reports, annual report season. So hopefully those will come in April. And then you guys added last time to discussion about affordable housing for artists. So I need to determine a date for that. We might be able to get that in one of those meetings, as well as an overview of code enforcement. That one we'll probably be able to have come sooner because we actually just did a presentation to Budget and Governance Committee yesterday on multifamily rental inspection program. So I think we can use a lot of what came out of that report to report to you guys on. I just need to coordinate with that staff on what meeting they can come to. So that one will probably come soon.
Wait, a presentation on rental inspection to the Budget Committee?
The Budget and Governance Committee of City Council.
Oh, City Council. Okay.
Yeah.
I see.
It was a request that had been made by City Council that was referred to the Budget and Governance Committee. So that's why it went there.
Which city council address?
At the time, it was Councilmember Carr, so it's Mayor Carr. She had made the referral, the request for it, and the council voted to refer it to that committee. So they can vote to refer it to one of their committees or to one of the advisory committees.
Is it a habitability inspection, or is it?
She wanted an understanding of the new state laws regarding multifamily rental inspections. And so that's what the report is on, all the different rental inspection requirements that the state law has passed over the last couple of years, and then what is our policy and what are we doing. So
is it multifamily rental inspections for the owner or for the renter? Who inspects what and why? What is it for?
It is the multifamily rental inspection requirement that the city must comply with in regards to complaints, code enforcement issues related to multifamily properties. So it would be inspections that code enforcement would be doing.
And so it's going to cover health and safety, habitability.
I can talk about that. That's why I said they just did a presentation, so I think that presentation. And they can add in some more to present back to you guys to answer all the questions you guys have about that.
That sounds super interesting.
Yeah. So that one will probably come sooner. I just need to confirm if they can come in March. If not March, then we'll do April. The only announcement I do have is that there is an upcoming fair housing training that's being put on by ECHO. It is on February 20th from 10 to 12. I have put the link to register on the city's website. But this is available for tenants, actually for any person, housing provider, tenant, owner, who's just interested in learning about state and federal fair housing laws, who's protected, how to do a reasonable accommodation, all those kind of things. ECHO puts on these trainings every couple of months, but this is the most recent one that is coming up. And they advertise this countywide. So.
Do they cover tenants' rights?
Not in the fair housing training. They do separate tenant right trainings from the fair housing. This is just about the state and federal fair housing requirements.
I had a quick question off topic of this, but maybe best of this section. I sit on the League of Women Voters tuned into the city council meeting last week, the last one that they had. And there was some questions in the meeting at the League of Women Voters about the project that was raised about the senior concerns,
Street.
Yes. It came up in the League of Women Voters meeting.
Okay.
Is there something I can track down the history of that project or like what?
Yes. I believe, yes, there is something.
Okay.
I need to figure out where that is because I don't know.
Okay.
And I stay in my lane.
Yeah, yeah.
But yes, I do believe there is something. Okay. It's something that's probably been produced by Public Works. I probably need to find. They had to do a presentation to the city council a couple months ago on the status and where they've been and all the outreach that they have done on that project. Okay. So I just need to figure out what that date is and where that report is, and I can send you the link or at least get you the date for that.
Then just to take a look.
Especially on that project. I really forgot to stay.
Is that going to be on Zoom too?
Yes. Yes, it will be on Zoom.
What project was that?
It's the bus only and bike improvements along 40th Street.
There's some concerns that were raised in the city council meeting.
That's all I have.
Okay.
Well,
that's a lot.
Yeah.
That's all you got?
It's all I have today.
And all within time.
So do you want
to during the housing committee meeting on February 4th, 2026 at 8 p.m.?
All right.
Yes.
Is that
okay? Yeah, thank you, guys. Yeah, I think it was all chat over the meeting.